on your own, to think things over. I'm always here, so you can visit whenever you like. I enjoyed it. Thank you. Let's talk again. Great. One last thing, if I may. Our discussion today was long and got pretty intense, and I guess I spoke rather rudely. For that, I'd like to apologize. Don't worry about it. You should read Plato's dialogues. The conduct and language of the disciples of Socrates are surprisingly loose. That's the way a dialogue is supposed to be.
The Second Night. All problems are interpersonal relationship problems.
The young man was good to his word. Exactly 1 week later, he returned to the philosopher's study. Truth be told, he'd felt the urge to rush back there only 2 or 3 days after his first visit. He had turned things over in his mind very carefully, and his doubts had turned to certainty. In short, teleology, the attributing of the purpose of a given phenomenon rather than its cause, was a sophistry. And the existence of trauma was beyond question. People cannot simply forget the past, and neither can they become free from it. Today, the young man decided, he had thoroughly dismantled this eccentric philosopher's theories and settle matters once and for all. Why you dislike yourself. Youth. So, after last time, I calmed myself down, focused, and thought things over. And yet, I've got to say, I still can't agree with your theories. Philosopher. Oh? What do you find questionable about them? Well, for instance, the other day I admitted that I dislike myself. No matter what I do, I can't find anything but shortcomings, and I can see no reason why I'd start liking myself. But of course, I still want to. You explain everything as having to do with goals. But what kind of goal could I have here? I mean, what kind of advantage could there be in my not liking myself? I can't imagine there'd be a single thing to gain from it. I see. You feel that you don't have any strong points, that you've got nothing but shortcomings. Whatever the facts might be, that's how you feel. In other words, your self-esteem is extremely low. So, the questions here, then, are why do you feel so wretched? And why do you view yourself with such low esteem? Because that's a fact. I really don't have any strong points. You're wrong. You notice only your shortcomings because you've resolved to not start liking yourself. In order to not like yourself, you don't see your strong points and focus only on your shortcomings. First, understand this point. I have resolved to not start liking myself? That's right. To you, not liking yourself is a virtue. Why? What for? Perhaps this is something you should think about yourself. What sort of shortcomings do you think you have? I'm sure you have already noticed. First of all, there's my personality. I don't have any self-confidence, and I'm always pessimistic about everything. And I guess I'm too self-conscious because I worry about what other people see, and then I live with a constant distrust of other people. I can never act naturally. There's always something theatrical about what I say and do. And it's not just my personality. There's nothing to like about my face or my body either. When you go about listing your shortcomings like that, what kind of mood does it put you in? Wow, that's nasty. An unpleasant mood, naturally. I'm sure that no one would want to get involved with a guy as warped as me. If there were anyone this wretched and bothersome in my vicinity, I'd keep my distance too. I see. Well, that settles it then. What do you mean? It might be hard to understand from your own example, so I'll use another. I use this study for simple counselling sessions. It must have been quite a few years ago. But there was a female student who came by. She sat right where you are sitting now, in the same chair. Well, her concern was her fear of blushing. She told me that she was always turning red whenever she was out in public, and that she would do anything to rid herself of this. So I asked her, "Well, if you can cure it, what will you want to do then?" And she said that there was a man she wanted. She secretly had feelings for him, but wasn't ready to divulge them. Once her fear of blushing was cured, she'd confess her desire to be with him. Youth. Huh. All right. It sounds like the typical thing a female student would seek counselling for. In order for her to confess her feelings for him, first she had to cure her blushing problem. But is that really the whole case? I have a different opinion. Why did she get this fear of blushing? And why hadn't it gotten better? Because she needed that symptom of blushing. What are you saying exactly? She was asking you to cure it, wasn't she? What do you think was the scariest thing to her? The thing she wanted to avoid most of all? It was that the man would reject her, of course. The fact that her unrequited love would negate everything for her. The very existence and possibility of I. This aspect is deeply present in adolescent unrequited love. But as long as she has a fear of blushing, she can go on thinking, "I can't be with him because I have this fear of blushing." It could end without her ever working up the courage to confess her feelings to him, and she could convince herself that he would reject her anyway. And finally, she can live in the possibility that, "If only my fear of blushing had gotten better, I could have." Youth. Okay, so she fabricated that fear of blushing as an excuse for her own inability to confess her feelings, or maybe as a kind of insurance for when he rejected her. Yes, you could put it that way. Okay, that is an interesting interpretation. But if that were really the case, wouldn't it be impossible to do anything to help her, since she simultaneously needs that fear of blushing and is suffering because of it? There'd be no end to her troubles. Well, this is what I told her. Fear of blushing is easy to cure. She asked, "Really?" I went on, "But I will not cure it." She pressed me. "Why?" I explained. "Look, it's thanks to your fear of blushing that you can accept your dissatisfaction with yourself and the world around you, and with a life that isn't going well. It's thanks to your fear of blushing, and it's caused by it." She asked, "How could it be?" I went on, "If I did cure it, and nothing in your situation changed at all, what would you do? You'd probably come here again and say, 'Give me back my fear of blushing,' and that would be beyond my abilities." Her story certainly isn't unusual. Students preparing for their exams think, "If I pass, life will be rosy." Company workers think, "If I get transferred, everything will go well." But even when those wishes are fulfilled, in many cases, nothing about their situations changes at all. Indeed, when a client shows up requesting a cure from fear of blushing, the counsellor must not cure the symptoms. If they do, recovery is likely to be even more difficult. That is the Adlerian psychology way of thinking about this kind of thing. So, what specifically do you do then? Do you ask what they're worried about and then just leave it? She didn't have confidence in herself. She was very afraid that things being what they were, he'd reject her even if she did confess to him. And if that happened, she'd lose even more confidence and get hurt. That's why she created the symptom of the fear of blushing. What I can do is to get the person first to accept myself now, and then, regardless of the outcome, have the courage to step forward. In Adlerian psychology, This kind of approach is called encouragement. Encouragement? Yes. I'll explain systematically what it consists of once our discussion has progressed a little farther. We're not at that stage yet. That works for me. In the meantime, I'll keep the word encouragement in mind. So, whatever happened to her? Apparently, she had the chance to join a group of friends and spend time with the man, and in the end it was he who confessed his desire to be with her. Of course, she never dropped by this study again after that. I don't know what became of her fear of blushing, but she probably didn't need it any longer. Yes, she clearly didn't have any use for it any more. That's right. Now, keeping this student's story in mind, let's think about your problems. You say that, at present, you notice only your shortcomings, and it's unlikely that you'll ever come to like yourself. And then, you said, I'm sure that no one would want to get involved with a guy as warped as me, didn't you? I'm sure you understand this already. Why do you dislike yourself? Why do you focus only on your shortcomings? And why have you decided to not start liking yourself? It's because you are overly afraid of being disliked by other people and getting hurt in your interpersonal relationships. What do you mean by that? Just like the young woman with the fear of blushing, who was afraid of being rejected by the man, you are afraid of being negated by other people. You're afraid of being treated disparagingly, being refused and sustaining deep mental wounds. You think that instead of getting entangled in such situations, it would be better if you just didn't have relations with anyone in the first place. In other words, your goal is to not get hurt in your relationships with other people. Huh. Now, how can that goal be realized? The answer is easy. Just find your shortcomings, start disliking yourself, and become someone who doesn't enter into interpersonal relationships. That way, if you can shut yourself into your own shell, you won't have to interact with anyone, and you'll even have a justification ready whenever other people snub you. That it's because of your shortcomings that you get snubbed. And if things weren't this way, you too could be loved. Ha-ha! Well, you've really put me in my place now. Don't be evasive. Being the way I am with all these shortcomings is, for you, a precious virtue. In other words, something that's to your benefit. Ouch! That hurts! What a sadist! You're diabolical. Okay, yes, it's true. I am afraid. I don't want to get hurt in interpersonal relationships. I'm terrified of being snubbed for who I am. It's hard to admit it, but you're right. Admitting is a good attitude. But don't forget, it's basically impossible to not get hurt in your relations with other people. When you enter into interpersonal relationships, it is inevitable that to a greater or lesser extent you will get hurt. And you will hurt someone too. Adler says, to get rid of one's problems, all one can do is live in the universe all alone. But one can't do such a thing.
All problems are interpersonal relationship problems. Youth. Wait a minute. I'm supposed to just let that one slip by? To get rid of one's problems, all one can do is live in the universe all alone? What do you mean by that? If you lived all alone, wouldn't you be horribly lonely? Philosopher. Oh, but being alone isn't what makes you feel lonely. Loneliness is having other people and society and community around you and having a deep sense of being excluded from them. To feel lonely, we need other people. That is to say, it is only in social context that a person becomes an individual. Youth. If you were really alone, that is, if you existed completely alone in the universe, you wouldn't be an individual and you wouldn't feel lonely either? Philosopher. I suppose the very concept of loneliness
wouldn't even come up. You wouldn't need language, and there'd be no use for logic or common sense either. But such a thing is impossible. Even if you lived on an uninhabited island, you would think about someone far across the ocean. Even if you spend your nights alone, you strain your ears to hear the sound of someone's breath. As long as there is someone out there somewhere, you will be haunted by loneliness. Youth. But then, you could just rephrase that as, if one could live in the universe all alone, one's problems would go away, couldn't you? Philosopher. In theory, yes. As Adler goes so far as to assert, all problems are interpersonal relationship problems. Can you say that again? We can repeat it as many times as you like. All problems are interpersonal relationship problems. This is a concept that runs to the very root of Adlerian psychology. If all interpersonal relationships were gone from this world, which is to say, if one were alone in the universe and all other people were gone, all manner of problems would disappear. Youth. That's a lie. It's nothing more than academic sophistry. Philosopher. Of course, we cannot do without interpersonal relationships. A human being's existence in its very essence assumes the existence of other human beings. Living completely separate from others is, in principle, impossible. As you are indicating, the premise, if one could live alone in the universe, is unsound. That's not the issue I'm talking about. Sure, interpersonal relationships are probably a big problem, that much I acknowledge. But to say that everything comes down to interpersonal relationship problems, now that's really an extreme position. What about the worry of being cut off from interpersonal relationships, the kind of problems that an individual agonizes over as an individual, problems directed to oneself? Do you deny all that? There is no such thing as worry that is completely defined by the individual. So-called internal worry does not exist. Whatever the worry that may arise, the shadows of other people are always present. But still, you're a philosopher. Human beings have loftier, greater problems than things like interpersonal relationships. What is happiness? What is freedom? And what is the meaning of life? Aren't these the themes that philosophers have been investigating ever since the ancient Greeks? And you're saying, so what? Interpersonal relationships are everything? It seems kind of pedestrian to me. It's hard to believe that a philosopher would say such things. Well, then, it seems there's a need to explain things a bit more concretely. Yes, please do. If you're going to tell me that you're a philosopher, then you've got to really explain things, or else this makes no sense. You were so afraid of interpersonal relationships that you came to dislike yourself. You've avoided interpersonal relationships by disliking yourself. These assertions shook the youth to his very core. The words had an undeniable truth that seemed to pierce his heart. Even so, he had to find a clear rebuttal to the statement that all the problems that people experience are interpersonal relationship problems. Adler was trivializing people's issues. The problems I'm suffering from aren't so mundane. Feelings of inferiority are subjective assumptions. Philosopher. Well, let's look at interpersonal relationships from a slightly different perspective. Are you familiar with the term feeling of inferiority? Youth. What a silly question. As you can surely tell from our discussion up to now, I'm just a huge blob of feelings of inferiority. What are those feelings specifically? Well, for instance, if I see something in a newspaper about a person around my age, someone who's really successful, I'm always overcome with these feelings of inferiority. If someone else who's lived the same amount of time I have is so successful, then what on earth am I doing with myself? Or when I see a friend who seems happy, before I even feel like celebrating with them, I'm filled with envy and frustration. Of course, this pimple-covered face doesn't help matters. And I've got strong feelings of inferiority when it comes to my education and occupation. And then there's my income and social standing. I guess I'm just completely riddled with feelings of inferiority.
I see. Incidentally, Adler is thought to be the first to use the term feeling of inferiority in the kind of context in which it is spoken of today.
I didn't know that.
In Adler's native German, the word is Minderwertigkeitsgefühl, which means a feeling, Gefühl, of having less, minder, worth, Wert. So, feeling of inferiority is a term that has to do with one's value judgment of oneself.
Value judgment?
It's the feeling that one has no worth, or that one is only worth so much.
Ah, that's a feeling I know well. That's me in a nutshell. Not a day goes by without me tormenting myself that there's no point in being alive.
Well then, let's have a look at my own feelings of inferiority. When you first met me, what was your impression in terms of physical characteristics?
Well, there's no need to hold back, be direct.
All right, I guess you were smaller than I'd imagined.
Thank you. I am 155 centimeters tall. Adler was apparently around the same height.
There was a time, until I was right around your age, actually, when I was concerned about my height. I was sure that things would be different if I were of average height, 20 or even just 10 centimeters taller, as if a more enjoyable life were waiting for me. I talked to a friend about it when I was having these feelings, and he said it was a bunch of nonsense and simply dismissed it.
That's horrible. Some friend.
And then he said, what would you do if you got taller? You know, you've got a gift for getting people to relax. With a man who's big and strong, it's true it does seem he can end up intimidating people just because of his size. With someone small, like me, on the other hand, people let go of their wariness. So it made me realize that having a small build was a desirable thing, both to me and to those around me. In other words, there was a transformation of values. I'm not worried about my height anymore.
Okay, but that's...
Wait until I'm finished. The important thing here is that my height of 155 centimeters wasn't inferior.
It wasn't inferior?
It was not, in fact, lacking in or lesser than something. Sure, my 155 centimeters is less than the average height, and an objectively measured number. At first glance, one might think it inferior. But the issue is really what sort of meaning I attribute to that height, what sort of value I give it.
What does that mean?
My feelings about my height were all subjective feelings of inferiority, which arose entirely through my comparing myself to others. That is to say, in my interpersonal relationships. Because if there hadn't been anyone with whom to compare myself, I wouldn't have had any occasion to think I was short. Right now, you too are suffering from various feelings of inferiority. But please understand that what you are feeling is not an objective inferiority, but a subjective feeling of inferiority. Even with an issue like height, it's all reduced to its subjectivity.
In other words, the feelings of inferiority we're suffering from are subjective interpretations rather than objective facts?
Exactly. Seeing it from my friend's point of view, that I could get people to relax or that I don't intimidate them, such aspects can become strong points. Of course, this is a subjective interpretation. You could even say it's an arbitrary assumption. However, there is one good thing about subjectivity. It allows you to make your own choice. Precisely because I am leaving it to subjectivity, the choice to view my height as either an advantage or disadvantage is left open to me.
Youth.
The argument that you can choose a new lifestyle? Philosopher. That's right. We cannot alter objective facts, but subjective interpretations can be altered as much as one likes. And we are all inhabitants of a subjective world. We talked about this at the very beginning, right? Yes, the well water, that's 18 degrees. Now, remember the German word for a feeling of inferiority, Minderwertigkeitsgefühl. As I mentioned a moment ago, feeling of inferiority is a term that has to do with one's value judgment of oneself. Then, what on earth could this value be? Okay, take diamonds, for instance, which are traded at a high value, or currency. We find particular values for these things and say that one carat is this much, that prices are such and such. But if you change your point of view, a diamond is nothing but a little stone. Youth. Well, intellectually it is. Philosopher. In other words, value is something that's based on a social context. The value given to a $1 bill is not an objectively attributed value, though that might be a common sense approach. If one considers its actual cost as printed material, the value is nowhere near a dollar. If I were the only person in this world and no one else existed, I'd probably be putting those $1 bills in my fireplace in wintertime. Maybe I'd be using them to blow my nose. Following exactly the same logic, there should have been no reason at all for me to worry about my height. Youth. If you were the only person in this world and no one else existed? Philosopher. Yes. The problem of value in the end brings us back to interpersonal relationships again. Youth. So this connects to what you were saying about all problems being interpersonal relationship problems. Yes, that's correct. An inferiority complex is an excuse. Youth. But can you say for sure that feelings of inferiority are really a problem of interpersonal relationships? Even the kind of person who is regarded socially as a success, who doesn't need to debase himself in relationships with other people, still has some feelings of inferiority. Even the businessman, who amasses enormous wealth, the peerless beauty who is the envy of all, and the Olympic gold medalist, every one of them would be plagued by feelings of inferiority. Well, that's how it seems to me. How should I think about this? Philosopher. Adler recognizes that feelings of inferiority are something everyone has. There's nothing bad about feelings of inferiority themselves. Youth. So why do people have them in the first place? Philosopher. It's probably necessary to understand this in a certain order. First of all, people enter this world as helpless beings, and people have the universal desire to escape from that helpless state. Adler called this the pursuit of superiority. Pursuit of superiority? This is something you could think of as simply hoping to improve or pursuing an ideal state. For instance, a toddler learns to steady himself on both legs. He has the universal desire to learn language and to improve. And all the advancements of science throughout human history are due to this pursuit of superiority, too. Okay, and then? The counterpart of this is the feeling of inferiority. Everyone is in this condition of wanting to improve. That is the pursuit of superiority. One holds up various ideals or goals and heads toward them. However, on not being able to reach one's ideals, one harbors a sense of being lesser. For instance, there are chefs who, the more inspired and accomplished they become, are forever beset with the sort of feeling of inferiority that makes them say to themselves, I'm still not good enough, or I've got to bring my cooking to the next level, and that sort of thing. That's true. Adler is saying that the pursuit of superiority and the feeling of inferiority are not diseases, but stimulants to normal, healthy, striving and growth. If it is not used in the wrong way, the feeling of inferiority, too, can promote striving and growth. The feeling of inferiority is a kind of launch pad. That's right. One tries to get rid of one's feeling of inferiority and keep moving forward. One's never satisfied with one's present situation. Even if it's just a single step, one wants to make progress. One wants to be happier. There is absolutely nothing wrong with the state of this kind of feeling of inferiority. There are, however, people who lose the courage to take a single step forward and who cannot accept the fact that the situation can be changed by making realistic efforts. People who, before even doing anything, simply give up and say things like, "I'm not good enough anyway," or, "Even if I tried, I wouldn't stand a chance." Youth. Well, that's true. There's no doubt about it. If the feeling of inferiority is strong, most people will become negative and say, "I'm not good enough anyway," because that's what a feeling of inferiority is. Philosopher. No, that's not a feeling of inferiority. That's an inferiority complex. A complex? That's what the feeling of inferiority is, isn't it? Be careful. The way the word complex is used today in our country, it seems to have the same meaning as feeling of inferiority. You hear people saying, "I've got a complex about my eyelids," or "he's got a complex about his education," that sort of thing. This is an utter misuse of the term. At base, complex refers to an abnormal mental state made up of a complicated group of emotions and ideas, and has nothing to do with the feeling of inferiority. For instance, there's Freud's Oedipus complex, which is used in the context of discussing the abnormal attraction of the child to the opposite sex parent. Youth. Yes, the nuances of abnormality are especially strong when it comes to the mother complex and the father complex. Philosopher. For the same reason, then, it's crucial to not mix up feeling of inferiority and inferiority complex, and to think about them as clearly separate. Youth. Concretely, how are they different? Philosopher. There is nothing particularly wrong with the feeling of inferiority itself. You understand this point now, right? As Adler says, the feeling of inferiority can be a trigger for striving and growth. For instance, if one had a feeling of inferiority with regard to one's education and resolved to oneself, "I'm not well educated, so I'll just have to try harder than anyone else," that would be a desirable direction. The inferiority complex, on the other hand, refers to a condition of having begun to use one's feeling of inferiority as a kind of excuse. So one thinks to oneself, "I'm not well educated, so I can't succeed," or "I'm not good-looking, so I can't get married." When someone is insisting on the logic of A is the situation, so B cannot be done, in such a way in everyday life that is not something that fits in the feeling of inferiority category. It is an inferiority complex. Youth. No, it's a legitimate causal relationship. If you're not well-educated, it takes away your chances of getting work or making it in the world. You're regarded as low on the social scale, and you can't succeed. That's not an excuse at all, it's just a cold hard fact, isn't it? No, you are wrong. How? Where am I wrong? What you are calling a causal relationship is something that Adler explains as apparent cause and effect. That is to say, you convince yourself that there is some serious causal relationship where there is none whatsoever. The other day, someone told me, "The reason I can't get married easily is that my parents got divorced when I was a child." From the viewpoint of Freudian etiology, the attributing of causes, the parents' divorce was a great trauma, which connects in a clear causal relationship with one's views on marriage. Adler, however, with his stance of teleology, the attributing of purpose, rejects such arguments as apparent cause and effect. Youth. Even so, the reality is that having a good education makes it easier to be successful in society.
I had thought you were wise to the ways of the world.
Philosopher, the real issue is how one confronts that reality. If what you are thinking is, I am not well educated, so I can't succeed, then instead of I can't succeed, you should think, I don't want to succeed.
Youth,
I don't want to succeed? What kind of reasoning is that?
Philosopher,
it's simply that it's scary to take even one step forward. Also, that you don't want to make realistic efforts. You don't want to change so much that you'd be willing to sacrifice the pleasures you enjoy now. For instance, the time you spend playing and engaged in hobbies. In other words, you're not equipped with the courage to change your lifestyle. It's easier with things just as they are now, even if you have some complaints or limitations.
Braggarts have feelings of inferiority.
Youth.
Maybe so, but
further, you harbour an inferiority complex about education and think, I'm not well educated, so I can't succeed. Put the other way around, the reasoning can be, if only I were well educated, I could be really successful.
True.
This is the other aspect of the inferiority complex. Those who manifest their inferiority complexes in words or attitudes, who say that A is the situation so B cannot be done, are implying that if only it were not for A, I'd be capable and have value.
Youth.
If only it weren't for this, I could do it too. Yes. As Adler points out, no one is capable of putting up with having feelings of inferiority for a long period of time. Feelings of inferiority are something that everyone has, but staying in that condition is too heavy to endure forever.
Huh? This is getting pretty confusing.
Okay, let's go over things one at a time. The condition of having a feeling of inferiority is a condition of feeling some sort of lack in oneself in the present situation. So then, the question is,
how do you fill in the part that's missing, right?
Exactly. How to compensate for the part that is lacking? The healthiest way is to try to compensate through striving and growth. For instance, it could be by applying oneself to one's studies, engaging in constant training, or being diligent in one's work. However, people who aren't equipped with that courage end up stepping into an inferiority complex. Again, it's thinking, I'm not well educated, so I can't succeed. And it's implying your capability by saying, if only I were well educated, I could be really successful. That the real me, which just happens to be obscured right now by the matter of education, is superior.
Youth.
No, that doesn't make sense. The second thing you're saying is beyond being a feeling of inferiority. That's really more bravado than anything else, isn't it?
Indeed.
The inferiority complex can also develop into another special mental state.
And what is that?
I doubt you have heard much about it. It's the superiority complex.
Superiority complex?
One is suffering from strong feelings of inferiority, and on top of that, one doesn't have the courage to compensate through healthy modes of striving and growth. That being said, one can't tolerate the inferiority complex of thinking, A is the situation, so B cannot be done. One can't accept one's incapable self. At that point, the person thinks of trying to compensate in some other fashion and looks for an easier way out.
What way is that?
It's to act as if one is indeed superior and to indulge in a fabricated feeling of superiority.
A fabricated feeling of superiority?
A familiar example would be giving authority.
What does that mean?
One makes a show of being on good terms with a powerful person. Broadly speaking, it could be anyone from the leader of your school class to a famous celebrity. And by doing that, one lets it be known that one is special. Behaviours like misrepresenting one's work experience, or excessive allegiance to particular brands of clothing are forms of giving authority and probably also have aspects of the superiority complex. In each case, it isn't that the I is actually superior or special. It is only that one is making the I look superior by linking it to authority. In short, it's a fabricated feeling of superiority. Youth. And at the base of that, there is an intense feeling of inferiority? Of course. I don't know much about fashion, but I think it's advisable to think of people who wear rings with rubies and emeralds on all their fingers as having issues with feelings of inferiority rather than issues of aesthetic sensibility. In other words, they have signs of a superiority complex. Right. But those who make themselves look bigger on borrowed power are essentially living according to other people's value systems. They are living other people's lives. This is a point that must be emphasized. Youth. So, a superiority complex, that's a very interesting psychology. Can you give me a different example? There's the kind of person who likes to boast about his achievements. Someone who clings to his past glory and is always recounting memories of the time when his light shone brightest. Maybe you know some people like this. All such people can be said to have superiority complexes. Youth. The kind of man who boasts about his achievements? Yes, it is an arrogant attitude. But he can boast because he actually is superior. You can't call that a fabricated feeling of superiority. Ah, but you are wrong. Those who go so far as to boast about things out loud actually have no confidence in themselves. As Adler clearly indicates, the one who boasts does so only out of a feeling of inferiority. Youth. You're saying that boasting is an inverted feeling of inferiority? That's right. If one really has confidence in oneself, one doesn't feel the need to boast. It's because one's feeling of inferiority is strong that one boasts. One feels the need to flaunt one's superiority all the more. There's the fear that if one doesn't do that, not a single person will accept one the way I am. This is a full-blown superiority complex. Youth. So though one would think from the sound of the words that inferiority complex and superiority complex were polar opposites, in actuality they border on each other. Yes. They are clearly connected. Now, there is one last example I'd like to give, a complex example that deals with boasting. It's a pattern leading to a particular feeling of superiority that manifests due to the feeling of inferiority itself becoming intensified. Concretely speaking, it's bragging about one's own misfortune. Bragging about one's own misfortune? The person who assumes a boasting manner when talking about his upbringing and the like, the various misfortunes that have rained down upon him. If someone should try to comfort this person or suggest some change be made, he'll refuse the helping hand by saying, "You don't understand how I feel." Well, there are people like that, but such people try to make themselves special by way of their experience of misfortune, and with the single fact of their misfortune, try to place themselves above others. Take the fact that I am short, for instance. Let's say that kind-hearted people come up to me and say, "It's nothing to worry about," or "Such things have nothing to do with human values." Now, if I were to reject them and say, "You think you know what short people go through, huh?" no one would say a thing to me anymore. I'm sure that everyone around me would start treating me just as if I were a boil about to burst, and would handle me very carefully, or should I say, circumspectly. Absolutely true. By doing that, my position becomes superior to other people's, and I can become special. Quite a few people try to be a special being by adopting this kind of attitude when they are sick or injured, or suffering the mental anguish of heartbreak.
Youth. So they reveal their feeling of inferiority and use it to their advantage?
Yes. They use their misfortune to their advantage and try to control the other party with it. By declaring how unfortunate they are and how much they have suffered, they are trying to worry the people around them, their family and friends, for example, and to restrict their speech and behavior and control them. The people I was talking about at the very beginning, who shut themselves up in their rooms, frequently indulge in feelings of superiority that use misfortune to their advantage. So much so that Adler himself pointed out, in our culture, weakness can be quite strong and powerful.
Youth. So, weakness is powerful?
Adler says, in fact, if we were to ask ourselves who is the strongest person in our culture, the logical answer would be the baby. The baby rules and cannot be dominated. The baby rules over the adults with his weakness, and it is because of this weakness that no one can control him.
I've never encountered that viewpoint.
Of course, the words of the person who has been hurt, "You don't understand how I feel," are likely to contain a certain degree of truth. Completely understanding the feelings of the person who is suffering is something that no one is capable of. But as long as one continues to use one's misfortune to one's advantage in order to be special, one will always need that misfortune.
The youth and philosopher had now covered a series of discussion topics: the feeling of inferiority, the inferiority complex, and the superiority complex. Psychology keywords, though they clearly were, the truths they contained differed greatly from the youth's imagined meanings. Still, something didn't feel right to him, somehow. What is it about all this that I'm having a hard time accepting?
Well, it must be the introductory part, the premise that is giving me doubts.
The youth calmly opened his mouth to speak.
Life is not a competition.
Youth. But I guess I still don't really get it.
Philosopher.
Okay, ask me anything you like.
Youth.
Adler recognizes that the pursuit of superiority, one's trying to be a more superior being, is a universal desire, doesn't he? On the other hand, he's striking a note of warning with regard to excessive feelings of inferiority and superiority. It'd be easy to understand if he could renounce the pursuit of superiority. Then I could accept it.
What are we supposed to do?
Philosopher.
Think about it this way. When we refer to the pursuit of superiority, there's a tendency to think of it as the desire to try to be superior to other people, as the desire to climb higher, even if it means kicking others down. You know, the image of ascending a stairway and pushing people out of the way to get to the top. Adler does not uphold such attitudes, of course. Rather, he's saying that on the same level playing field, there are people who are moving forward, and there are people who are moving forward behind them. Keep that image in mind. Though the distance covered and the speed of walking differ, everyone is walking equally in the same flat place. The pursuit of superiority is the mindset of taking a single step forward on one's own feet, not the mindset of competition of the sort that necessitates aiming to be greater than other people.
Youth. So life is not a competition?
That's right. It's enough to just keep moving in a forward direction without competing with anyone. And, of course, there is no need to compare oneself with others.
Youth.
No, that's impossible. We'll always compare ourselves to other people no matter what. That's exactly where our feeling of inferiority comes from, isn't it?
Philosopher. A healthy feeling of inferiority is not something that comes from comparing oneself to others, but from one's comparison with one's ideal self.
But, look, all of us are different. Gender, age, knowledge, experience, appearance. No two of us are exactly the same.
let's acknowledge in a positive manner the fact that other people are different from us, and that we are not the same, but we are equal. We are not the same, but we are equal. That's right. Everyone is different. Don't mix up that difference with good and bad and superior and inferior. Whatever differences we may have, we are all equal. Youth. No distinction of rank for people. Idealistically speaking, I suppose so. But aren't we trying to have an honest discussion about reality now? Would you really say, for instance, that I, an adult and a child who is still struggling with his arithmetic, are equal? Philosopher. In terms of the amount of knowledge and experience, and then the amount of responsibility that can be taken, there are bound to be differences. The child might not be able to tie his shoes properly, or figure out complicated mathematical equations, or be able to take the same degree of responsibility as an adult when problems arise. However, such things shouldn't have anything to do with human values. My answer is the same. Human beings are all equal, but not the same. Youth. Then are you saying that a child should be treated like a full-grown adult? No. Instead of treating the child like an adult or like a child, one must treat them like a human being. One interacts with the child with sincerity, as another human being, just like oneself. Youth. Let's change the question. All people are equal. They're on the same level playing field. But actually, there's a disparity here, isn't there? Those who move forward are superior, and those who pursue them from behind are inferior. So we end up at the problem of superior and inferior, don't we? Philosopher. No, we do not. It does not matter if one is trying to walk in front of others or walk behind them. It is as if we are moving through a flat space that has no vertical axis. We do not walk in order to compete with someone. It is in trying to progress past who one is now that there is value. Youth. Have you become free from all forms of competition? Of course. I do not think about gaining status or honor, and I live my life as an outsider philosopher without any connection whatsoever to worldly competition. Youth. Does that mean you dropped out of competition? That you somehow accepted defeat? No. I withdrew from places that are preoccupied with winning and losing. When one is trying to be oneself, competition will inevitably get in the way. No way. That's a tired-out old man's argument. Young folks like me have to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps amid the tension of competition. It's because I don't have a rival running alongside me that I can't outdo myself. What's wrong with thinking of interpersonal relationships as competitive? If that rival was someone you could call a comrade, it's possible that it would lead to self-improvement. But in many cases, a competitor will not be your comrade. Meaning what exactly? You are the only one worrying about your appearance. Philosopher. Let's tie up the loose ends. At the outset, you expressed dissatisfaction with Adler's definition that all problems are interpersonal relationship problems, right? That was the basis for our discussion on feelings of inferiority. Yes, that's correct. The subject of feelings of inferiority was too intense, and I was on the verge of forgetting that point. Why did you bring up the subject in the first place? It is connected with the subject of competition. Please remember that. If there is competition at the core of a person's interpersonal relationships, he will not be able to escape interpersonal relationship problems or escape misfortune. Why not? Because at the end of a competition, there are winners and losers. It's perfectly fine to have winners and losers. Give some thought to it, then. If it were you, specifically, who had a consciousness of being in competition with the people around you, in your relations with them, you will have no choice but to be conscious of victory or defeat. Mr. A got into this famous university, Mr. B found work at that big company, and Mr. C has hooked up with such a nice-looking woman, and you'll compare yourself to them and think, this is all I've got.
Ha ha, that's pretty specific.
When one is conscious of competition and victory and defeat, it is inevitable that feelings of inferiority will arise, because one is constantly comparing oneself to others and thinking, I beat that person or I lost to that person. The inferiority complex and the superiority complex are extensions of that. Now, what kind of being do you think the other person is to you at that point?
I don't know. A rival, I guess.
No, not a mere rival. Before you know it, you start to see each and every person, everyone in the whole world, as your enemy.
My enemy?
You start to think that people are always looking down on you and treating you with scorn, that they're all enemies who must never be underestimated, who lie in wait for any opening and attack at the drop of a hat. In short, that the world is a terrifying place.
Enemies who must never be underestimated. That's who I'm in competition with.
This is what is so terrifying about competition. Even if you're not a loser, even if you're someone who keeps on winning, if you are someone who has placed himself in competition, you will never have a moment's peace. You don't want to be a loser. And you always have to keep on winning if you don't want to be a loser. You can't trust other people. The reason that so many people don't really feel happy while they're building up their success in the eyes of society is that they are living in competition. Because to them, the world is a perilous place that is overflowing with enemies.
I suppose so, but
do other people actually look at you so much? Are they really watching you around the clock and lying in wait for the perfect moment to attack? Seems rather unlikely. A young friend of mine, when he was a teenager, used to spend a lot of time in front of the mirror arranging his hair. And once, when he was doing that, his grandmother said, "You're the only one who's worried how you look." He says that it got a bit easier for him to deal with life after that.
Youth. Hey, that's a dig at me, isn't it? Sure, maybe I do see the people around me as enemies. I'm constantly in fear of being attacked, of the arrows that could come flying at me at any moment. I always think that I'm being watched by others, that I'm being subjected to harsh judgment, and that I'm going to be attacked. And it's probably true that this is a self-conscious reaction, just like the mirror-obsessed teenager. The people of the world aren't paying attention to me. Even if I were to go walking on my hands down the street, they'd take no notice. But I don't know. Are you saying, after all, that my feeling of inferiority is something that I chose, that has some sort of goal? That just doesn't make any sense to me.
And why is that?
I have a brother who is 3 years older than I am. He fits the classic image of the big brother. He always does what our parents say. He excels in his studies and in sports, and he's the very picture of diligence. And from the time I was little, I was always compared to him. He is older and more advanced, so of course I could never beat him at anything. Our parents did not care at all about such circumstances, and never gave me any sign of recognition. Whatever I did, I got treated like a child, and I was berated at every opportunity and told to be quiet. I learned to keep my feelings to myself. I've lived my life totally steeped in feelings of inferiority, and I had no choice but to be conscious of being in competition with my brother.